Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Today is a special one-hour episode of Loud and Clear. We spend the entire hour with Black Lives Matter organizer DeRay McKesson. He is now running for mayor in the city of Baltimore. Welcome, DeRay McKesson.
Good to be here. Thanks so much for the invitation.
So last week was the anniversary of the killing of Freddie Gray, the young man whose death at the hands of Baltimore police led to protests and finally an uprising in Baltimore. I mean, looking back a year later, just reflect on that killing, on the uprising, and what happened then and what's happened since.
The protests in Ferguson mobilized people all across the country to understand that the issues around police violence were much closer to them. And the death of Freddie Gray brought the movement in so many ways to the streets of Baltimore that people had been organizing in Baltimore long before Freddie had been killed. But this made it a citywide issue in a way that was new for the city. What we saw was people take to the streets. We saw the confrontation with the police. We saw the curfew. We saw an empty Oriole Stadium. What's happened since the past year is that there's legislation at the State House around changing the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights. We're seeing people organize all across the city around issues of safety differently. And in the mayoral election right now, we're seeing these issues around policing and safety at the forefront in ways that they've never been before in the city.
Let's talk about your own campaign. You came back to Baltimore. You were part of the Ferguson protests. You were in Baltimore. You grew up in Baltimore, in the Baltimore area. Now you're running for mayor. What's your main message with your campaign?
Yeah, so it's two core tenets. One is about strategy, that there are incredible resources and talents in the city. And what there isn't is a plan. So in the absence of a plan, people are doing work in silos that are having minimal impact. And the second is about scale. How do we make sure that we have our solutions at scale? Because so many of our problems are at scale in the city. We think about 70,000 people addicted to drugs, 40% of our adults not functionally literate, about 25% of our pre-K students are chronically absent. They miss 20 days or more. So the platform is not just about crime, safety, and education. It is about those issues because those are top of mind and important issues. But it's also about public health, about the environment, about transportation and infrastructure, about arts and culture. It is about how we make a whole city whole again.
So Baltimore, as you said, has had, before Freddie Gray, not only the problems of police repression and police violence and over-policing by the police, but the problems of chronic unemployment, great, great poverty, huge income disparities. And for large numbers of young people who are going to school or went to school in Baltimore, sort of being defuturized by the social and economic order inside of Baltimore, it would seem to me that message, your message from the grassroots, should be resonating, especially with young people. Do you see young people as your base?
I think of the under 35 group as my base primarily. But what we saw both in Baltimore and in cities across the country is that the coalition of people coming out around these issues was so broad. And we saw an intergenerational group of people of all races and all faiths coming out and saying that we can live in a world where the police don't kill people. We can live in a world where we understand that the safety of our communities is predicated on more than the presence of police. And that's really important.
The New York Times just did a major article about you. I see that you're smiling, and I know why you would be smiling. The New York Times says, DeRay McKesson is running for mayor. He will not be mayor of Baltimore. But then did a very, very long piece about what your campaign means, what the Black Lives Matter movement means. Talk about how you reacted when you saw the Times article.
You know, the article, I think, misses the context on so many things. You know, you think about this election is that this is the first election in the history of the city where the presidential primary and the mayoral primary will fall on the same day. So the electorate will just be different. So when it references the polls, what I know to be true is about 75% of the people polled are over the age of 50. Only 6% are under the age of 35. We anticipate the electorate itself will just be different. You know, I have the third highest number of donors from Baltimore City, which shows clear support. And from day one, this is going to be an 83-day campaign. So what you didn't see in the article is that, you know, the reporter actually followed me to an event that was hosted by a citizen of Baltimore who just reached out to me, who was a supporter and said, DeRay, I'm going to rent out a bar. get my friends together so you can come do a Q&A. You know, it was full of people I'd never met before that we knocked on doors. And the article suggests that I'm the only person knocking on doors. We knocked on 800 doors as a campaign yesterday. So I think that it tells you a story. It doesn't tell you the story of a campaign.
Yeah. And also, all of the conventional wisdom this year especially is pretty much off the mark when it comes to candidates and campaigns. I mean, you look at the Bernie Sanders campaign, for instance. Sanders ran as was an independent, a socialist in the U.S. Senate, but considered to have no prospects for success at all within the Democratic primary. And yet he's getting tens of thousands of people and millions of small donors. Certainly the establishment didn't see it that way. Do you find some correlation, even though there are obviously differences between what you're doing and, say, what Bernie Sanders is trying to do in terms of getting a kind of grassroots electoral upsurge from below?
Yeah, this is about making sure that the issues are front and center. And I think Bernie has shown that to be important, that he's going to talk about issues that politically have been unpopular, but are the right issues to talk about. And my campaign in Baltimore has been focused on making sure we talk about the issues. It also has been saying that we anticipate that a new electorate is going to come out and vote. And I think that that's powerful. For the first time, the mayoral election will be down ballot, you know, to be down from the presidential election, which is important. And it is saying that people are tired of establishment politics, that there's a type of politics that has run cities, has run the federal government for so long. And that just cannot be the way that we're going to see transformative change in our cities and our states and at the national level.
So when you talk about transformative change, say in Baltimore or in other cities or non-cities, non-urban areas, in other words, in the United States of America, what is the transformative change you're looking for?
So it is about, how do we make systems and structures equitable for people, especially disadvantaged people, historically marginalized people? So in Baltimore, you know, we could today make an adult literacy strategy that had a diploma granting program for adults. We could do it. We could have a home visit strategy for our earliest learners that touched every kid born in the city in a given year, about 7,000 kids. We could actually scale that up and make sure that every kid is a first library. Like, we could do that work. We can make sure that the police department is accountable. You know, in Baltimore, it's not against the use of force policy for there to be chokeholds or hog tying. We can change that. And there's so many things that we can do right now that would actually make the city stronger, would make neighborhoods safer, would make schools better equipped to teach our kids every single day. That there's a set of things that we can do that'll affect people's todays and tomorrows.
Baltimore used to be a center of industry. It had steel, of course, a very major port. It was an industrial town, and it had a very, very strong labor movement. Many of those jobs are gone. They're gone not because of local policies, but because of the nature of neoliberal globalization. Many of those jobs are overseas. What does it mean to have, for a mayor in a city like Baltimore, to have a jobs program, for instance?
Yeah, so in Baltimore, you know, what happens, unfortunately, far too often is that we attract jobs to the city and we wind up employing the region and not city residents. And that is primarily because we have not invested in skill development and training in a robust way. So you think about, what does it mean that 40% of our adults are not functionally literate? But that's hard to get a good paying job if you can't read. You think about transportation in the city. We know that the neighborhoods with the highest unemployment rates are also the neighborhoods with the longest commutes. Right now, the mayor has no direct impact on the public transportation system. We have to change that in the city. And those are actually key parts of the job strategy, that it's one thing to attract businesses. It's another thing to make sure that the citizens in Baltimore are actually equipped to take advantage of those. And then there is, you know, there's some things about the law. You know, I'm calling for the hiring commitment that is law now to be changed. Right now it says that 51% of the employees on contracts, like development projects, have to be from the city. But that allows people to fudge it. And I want it to be 51% of the hours, because that actually holds the developers accountable to make sure that it is equitable for city residents.
Right. The problem of housing, of gentrification here in Washington, D.C., where we are, it's massive. I mean, the social and racial demographic of the city has changed dramatically. You know, 30 years ago, even 20 years ago, perhaps 15 years ago, Washington, D.C. was a majority black city. Baltimore had a very, very large black population. I'm not sure if it's the majority or was the majority. But in terms of affordable housing, I mean, we have issues like rent control, things that used to be a real centerpiece of economic development for urban dwellers. Where do you stand on that in Baltimore?
So, you know, we do need to change. We need to reform rent court. Renters have very little rights in the city. So I'm calling to make sure that there's at least a 14-day waiting period before people can get evicted, that there are actually legal services for people who are being represented, for people who are representing themselves. But what's important to know about the vacant and abandoned home strategy, which is a key part of the housing strategy, given the sheer number of vacant and abandoned homes we have in the city, is that we know that people do not move into neighborhoods where there are more than 4% vacant and abandoned homes. And the proximity to and from 4% actually changes the tools in the toolkit that we can use to address this issue in communities. We also know that this is a neighborhood by neighborhood strategy. So we have to look at neighborhoods with 30% vacant homes, different than neighborhoods with 6% vacant homes. And that means that we use all the tools in our toolkit given the neighborhood, whether that's the vacants to value, whether that's the dollar home program, whether that's vouchers, enforcing the inclusionary housing law, rehab, renovation. There's no one size fits all, but it is about saying, here are the tools that we need to use for a given neighborhood to make sure that we respect the culture of that neighborhood and also to make sure that we have people living in homes. And the last thing is about transportation. And we know that people who commute more than 45 minutes to work each day, that two things happens. One is that their happiness decreases, and the second is their reliability decreases. The transportation is a part of has to be a part of the housing strategy. And where your happiness decreases, you move, and that's bad because an employed person leaves the neighborhood. And then when your reliability decreases, you lose your job, and that's bad for you and the neighborhood. So the housing strategy is about so much more than just housing per se. And we also know that it's a part of the food desert strategy. I can't attract a supermarket to move into a neighborhood where I can't attract people to move into.
Very good. We're talking with DeRay McKesson. He has been a prominent leader in the movement for Black Lives or the Black Lives Matter movement. Very well known on Forbes' list of great leaders from last year. He's now running for the mayor of Baltimore. One of the reasons I thought it was important, DeRay, for our audience to hear you, we have both an audience here in the United States and also a global audience, is that New York Times article, which is very prominent and which goes all around the world, sort of tried to caricature your campaign, I thought, by sort of indicating that you were a flash in the pan candidate. You were representative of one strand of society, the struggle for Black lives, the struggle against police brutality, but that you did not really have a serious program. But anybody listening to your program can see that your program is comprehensive. It's about transportation, about housing, about unemployment and employment, about education. I mean, you are a serious candidate. Why is it, do you think, that the Baltimore establishment won't take you as seriously as obviously hundreds of thousands of people who follow you on Twitter and social media do?
Remember, this piece was not written by a Baltimore newspaper. The Baltimore newspaper has actually been really responsive and has done an op-ed that has highlighted the importance of the platform. Just recently, a piece came out that talked about my plans for good government and noted that I had the most innovative plans overall. So the Baltimore press has actually been really thoughtful and engaged both in the campaign and in the platform. I think that it is hard for people to think about politics in new and innovative ways in general. And I think that sometimes the national press has been slow to look at a campaign and say that we could actually make change in 80 days, that my platform in and of itself, just running and putting the platform out, forced the other candidates to think about issues differently and brought a set of issues to the forefront. And then I've had a host of meet and greets and door knocking with people all across the city, and they are responsive to the campaign. Does that always show up in every single piece written about me? No, but it is true nonetheless. So I'm looking forward to Election Day, and we are down to the final days.
We have about a minute left before the end of our first segment. I want to ask you, if it turns out that you don't win the election in Baltimore for mayor, what are your plans going forward? Not that I'm suggesting that you should plan not to be the mayor, but obviously as an activist, you're thinking about this not just for one election, but in a long-term way.
You know, I'm focused on April 26th.
Okay, so April 26th is it. That's the Democratic primary, which in the case of the Baltimore mayoral election is the general election, more or less, because of the nature of politics in Baltimore. We are talking with organizer DeRay McKesson. He is running for mayor in Baltimore. He was and is a leader of the Black Lives Matter movement. DeRay, we're going to go to a break in 45 seconds, but I want to go back and talk about the big picture with the Black Lives Matter movement. How was it that you came to Ferguson? Talk for about 45 seconds. We'll take a short break, and then we'll pick it up after our break.
Got off my couch on August 16th, drove 9 hours, ended up in the streets in St. Louis. I joined alongside so many people who were doing incredible work, and that was the beginning of my story.
And where did you drive from?
I was in Minneapolis at the time. I was the senior director of human capital with Minneapolis Public Schools.
Okay, we've been talking and we'll continue to talk with DeRay McKesson running for mayor in the city of Baltimore. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're speaking with organizer DeRay McKesson, who is the candidate for mayor, a candidate for mayor in the city of Baltimore, his hometown. DeRay has been a leader in the Black Lives Matter movement. DeRay, before we went to break, I asked you, how did you get involved? How did you end up at Ferguson? You said you got off the couch, you drove 9 hours, and you joined a lot of other people who were already in the streets. Talk about, if you would, what you believe will be the historic significance of what happened in Ferguson, not just the killing of Mike Brown, but, of course, the uprising, the sustained uprising and its consequences afterwards. Big picture, where do you think this will land in history?
I think that one of the most powerful things about the movement is that it was not born out of institutions like churches or schools, that it was people who came outside and said, we will not go home, that we will not be moved, that we will continue to fight and depress. And that what we saw was that our access to social media and digital tools allowed us to organize and amplify the work in ways that had not been done before. That we, as people of color, often face these issues of erasure, and erasure manifests in two ways primarily. One is that the story is never told, or is told by everybody but us. But in this moment, we were the unerased. So we were able to push back, you know, dominant culture narratives and to connect with each other in ways that were just new. And we saw that spirit, and we saw the organizing work in St. Louis then start to traverse the whole country. So we saw it spread to cities across the country, and we saw the unrest really push systems and structures to do better. And it opened up space for a public conversation about race and policing that literally had not happened before.
The struggle for civil rights in the 1950s and the 1960s that led, of course, to the Civil Rights Act being passed in 1964, the Voting Rights Act in 1965, and then the introduction of affirmative action programs, not under a Democrat, but even under the right-wing and, I would say, openly racist administration of Richard Nixon. All of those were the consequences of the people's struggle. Obviously, the composition of the U.S. Congress that passed the Civil Rights Act was the same composition of Congress that in 1954 upheld apartheid in America. That movement was a movement that had very specific and particular focused demands: the end of segregation, the Civil Rights Act, as I said, the Voting Rights Act. How do you think of this movement today in terms of not only its similarities, but its differences? How do you compare it, say, to the struggle, the freedom struggle, the enduring struggle that has gone on for so long, but the struggle that sort of reached a peak in the about 1970, 71, 72, and then ebbed for a couple of generations?
Yeah, you know, we did not discover injustice last August or August 2014. We didn't invent resistance. And we exist in a legacy of struggle. And what is different about this moment is that we have access to tools that other people did not have access to. So we can be our own storytellers. We can amplify messages and videos, and we can tell this story over and over and connect with people in ways that just couldn't happen in the 60s. And that is really our power in this moment, that we are not reliant on mainstream media to be the only vehicle by which our stories are told. And that's incredibly powerful. Besides that, the issues are strikingly similar. You know, Rodney King, you think about so many of the protests that happens in the 60s, the police were really violent. That we're actually still enduring so many of the same things. Again, the tools that we have access to are very different now.
When you see the incidences of police violence and police murder, I think the Malcolm X grassroots movement put out a study that showed that every 28 hours, a black person in the United States was killed by either a police officer or a security guard. I think when you look at the numbers for the last 2 years, now that numbers are being counted more by, say, the Washington Post, the FBI and the federal government doesn't count, the numbers are actually even higher than that. It's not an accident. It's not incidental. It's not just determined by location. It's not, quote, the Deep South or places where you would associate the most heinous revelations of white supremacy. What do you think accounts for it?
You know, I'm mindful that in this moment, we now have more data than we had before. With every 28 hours that the Malcolm X grassroots movement put out, it was just one of the many data points. And there is actually more information about who the police have killed than we've ever seen before. So we think about the Fatal Encounters database. We think about killbypolice.net. We think about the work of mapping police violence that I worked on with so many other activists like Sam, Annetta, and Brittany. And this work has actually empowered activists to use the data to press, not only to tell the story with numbers, but also to press about what change looks like. So we know that in 2015, for instance, the police killed someone every day but 18 days. The data has actually been really informative in helping us push back against narratives that say that, you know, because neighborhoods are dangerous, that's why the police are killing people. That's not true, that the Ferguson effect is not a real thing, that there were no spikes in crime because the police, you know, chose not to do their job. Like, our access to data is unparalleled at this point, coupled with our access to technology to continue to spread messages. And that is that I think will also be a defining moment of the movement. There is something about the fact that we experience a trauma so often. So every 28 hours, that means that there's a lot of killing going on. And this is actually really close to people. And what we saw across the country is that people started to realize, you know what, this is actually in my neighborhood too. This is in my town too. This is in my city too. And it took us like 9 months to get there. And it wasn't until the death of Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, that people across the country were like, okay, this is a problem where I am too, not just in St. Louis.
So we have an epidemic of killing. I mean, it is an epidemic of killing. And the movement has highlighted it. And there's a bright light now that didn't exist before on police forces all over the country. And with the technology, both the video cameras and the ability to communicate through social media, every incident of police terror or police violence or police murder can be quickly, instantly communicated to others and create mass outrage. And yet it's not diminishing.
Yeah, so I'm also mindful that the movement is young, that we won't undo 400 years of racism in 400 days, right? That's not how this works. I also know that it takes the awareness to be firmly rooted for people to then go and make systemic change. So what we have seen across the country is a host of laws that are changing structures and systems, and that work is often slow, but it's work that's happening. We see use of force policies across the country starting to be amended. We see police union contracts starting to be amended. Like, we see this work happening. But it's slow work, that the movement is a young movement. And it's important that people have actually sustained the energy over time, that people are continuing to organize, that you think about the first beginning, the movement was about awareness. Then we helped people see that there were real solutions. So we met with Bernie and Hillary and President Obama and Loretta Lynch and Valerie Jarrett, that this was about saying, here are some real solutions. And then you see people doing the work in their own neighborhoods, in city councils and state houses. But this work happens at a pace that is, you know, not as quick as anyone would like, but it's happening.
In terms of the impact the Obama administration has had on the country and its connection or lack of connection to the movement for Black Lives, how do you view the Obama administration's position and its role during the past 7 years or since Ferguson, since the uprising in Ferguson following the killing of Michael Brown?
Well, the DOJ report on the Ferguson Police Department was an important report because they uncovered and documented so many instances of police violence that were specifically coded to race. The consent decree with Ferguson City is a model consent decree. There are provisions in that consent decree that don't exist in any of the other ones, and they're very aggressive. And I think that we will see that continue to be a model for how the DOJ holds police departments accountable. And the president's task force on 21st century policing, the recommendations that came out of it are actually both common sense and progressive, and important that they get adopted at the local, state, and federal level. What has been a challenge is that the rhetoric of President Obama has not always matched the commitment that he seems to share. So when he calls protesters thugs, for instance, that word is coded and means something in community. And I do think there's a question about pace. You know, it's like, why is there not a federal use of force standard at the federal level? Federal agents, right? Why do, when FBI agents kill civilians just in public, their names aren't released, right? Like the federal government can actually be a model with regard to some of this work and does not seem to be stepping up as a model. And I do think that that's a missed opportunity.
In the last 2 years, there's been a multitude of organizations and leaderships and collectives that have formed. There's not a leadership. It's not a monolith. In the 1960s or 50s, there were more formal organizations that had national chapters and memberships and recognized leaderships that had a certain kind of stability. That they were often anchored in the, at least in the 50s and 60s, in the Black church. I'm talking now about the civil rights movement more than the anti-war movement or the LGBTQ movement or what was then the gay rights movement. How do you view the issue of leadership and organization for the movement today?
Yeah, so I'm mindful that there's no one leader, no one organization, no two or three people leading the movement, but that the movement is being led by so many people, so many leaders across the country and communities and neighborhoods. I also know the difference between organization and infrastructure. What we saw in the civil rights movement were organizations leading so much of the work. I think what we see in the movement today is that there can be infrastructure, whether they're organizations or not. And I think about in Ferguson, I was one of the people tweeting as I protested and organized. There were people who were live streaming as they protested and organized. There were people who were the bail fund, and the infrastructure emerged and we made it happen. And people found a role and we all learned how to work together. So I think that we are at this interesting point where you don't necessarily need an organization to do change, and organizations will always have a role to play. With that said, there are people who want to be members of this work who don't, or who want to be involved in this work, but don't necessarily want to be members of something. They want to do discrete tasks that'll help us get to a larger goal, and we have to make space for them too.
Have you been back to Ferguson? I mean, in the last period?
Yeah, I've been, not since I announced that I was running for mayor, but before that, yes.
Yeah, and how do you find it in Ferguson? I mean, do you have a sense of what the community, what the mood is in the community? There have been, there is a consent decree. There has been other attempted reforms in terms, I mean, the police were imposing huge, massive fines on people for this, that, and the next thing. In other words, the community really did live in a state of terror. It wasn't just about whether a cop pulled the trigger and shot somebody. There was a police state in Ferguson. Has that changed, or is there a change in the mood in terms of that, those kind of issues?
So I've not been there that recent enough to talk from experience about that right now, because I've not been back definitely since the election. From connecting with people who are still there and organizing, I think that the spirit of resistance is strong, that they just ran a candidate for city council and in some of the other elections there. People organized around the consent decree and the adoption of the consent decree, and that the protesters remain an organized group and focused on issues of equity and justice, especially with regard to the police department and the city of Ferguson itself.
There's been some talk in the media that the movement, which was in the streets almost every day, and we can I can remember that here in Washington, not just every day, but there were multiple demonstrations every day by different sectors. And as you said, it was spontaneous. You could go to the White House on 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. There'd be a walkout from this high school. Then the next day or a few hours later, a group would come from college students, and then workers who were, you know, on lunch break came down. I mean, it was just nobody was leading it. It was like just a spontaneous outpouring of the people. And that was true in New York. And then there was the killing of those two police officers. They were ambushed and by somebody who was insane and who was then either committed suicide or was killed. And then the police in New York City, for instance, used that as to take a counteroffensive against the movement and said, in some ways, the movement must be responsible for this, you know, the terrible assassinations of these two police officers. And the movement was pushed back. But then it seemed as if the movement, not just in New York, but around the country, started to diminish somewhat in terms of its level of activism. Do you think that's happened? And is it just a phase, or what do you make of it?
I don't think that there's a diminishment. I think that the purpose of the street actions changed. That at the beginning, it was 9 months of helping people everywhere see that the crisis was much closer to them than they originally thought. It was important to shut down streets because it brought attention to the crisis. And again, with the death of Freddie Gray, Sandra Bland, Walter Scott, people accepted the, they were like, okay, I get it. But the issue is close to me. But this is my issue too, and I need to do something about it. And once that happened, the need for consistent in-street protests changed. It's just different. And what you saw was people potentially not be in the street as much, but still be meeting. And meeting around how do we actually get to systemic and structural change. So if we think about protest as truth-telling at its core, that we stood in streets to tell the truth with our bodies, that Mike should be alive and Rakia should be alive and Freddie should be alive. People disrupted board meetings and commission hearings to tell the truth that people weren't using their institutional power in ways that supported Black people or marginalized people well. The truth is also that we have to be intentional about how we press systems and structures to change. And sometimes that is being in the street. Sometimes that is calling somebody's office. Sometimes that is visiting the office. Sometimes that is going to school board meetings. That, like, there are many ways to tell the truth in public. And the tactics will continue to evolve as the movement grows. So not a diminishment. What we have seen is growth. That the movement is maturing. And as a movement matures, the tactics mature.
We have about a minute left before our last break. But I want to ask you, what about repression? Because you look at what happened in Minneapolis. I mean, people really got hit hard by the police. There was injunctions in California. You have the people whose charges were dropped who blocked the 101 freeway. Those charges are being brought back. I mean, there's been a lot of pushback by police forces. Do you think that's had an impact on the movement?
So we clearly know it's happening. I will, you know, organizers and activists and protesters know that that is a risk. So I think about when I was arrested, I knew that there would be consequences. The consequences were, you know, I knew that they were going to happen. And that factored in to whether I was going to be out there or not. If I got arrested, and I didn't plan to get arrested, but I knew that being in the property or being around it might make me subject to arrest. And organizers and activists understand that as a cost to the work. And the strategies for fighting that change depending on the city itself.
We are talking to DeRay McKesson. He is running for mayor in the city of Baltimore. April 26th is the primary, the Democratic primary, which will decide who will be the mayor in Baltimore because the Republicans don't stand a chance in the city of Baltimore. Where he's also a leader of the Black Lives Matter movement. He has a national and internationally following. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back with DeRay McKesson.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking with DeRay McKesson. He is an organizer with the Black Lives Matter movement, or the Movement for Black Lives. He is also running for mayor in the city of Baltimore. Before the break, we talked about the fact that the police and police forces, law enforcement, has carried out acts of repression against activists. In spite of that, the movement has continued. It's manifesting itself in different ways. DeRay McKesson, I want to talk to you also about the current 2016 electoral cycle. You're involved in the campaign for mayor of Baltimore, but we have the national presidential election and the phenomena of Donald Trump. And Trump has surprised the Republican establishment. His support comes from below, not from Wall Street, even though he's a billionaire himself. And his message is immigrants have to be driven out of the country. They have to be deported, that Muslims should be banned. In other words, it's an open campaign for xenophobia and attacking Muslims and immigrants. Really, it's a base of white supremacy. How does it look to the Black Lives Matter movement? How do you perceive the need for unity, say, with other communities, in particular Latinos, immigrants, Muslims? What do you think about that?
Yeah, so there's consensus that Donald Trump's campaign is centered on bigotry and racism, and that he has espoused these views about a host of communities that are both dangerous and problematic. What's interesting about Trump is that he has also done irreparable damage to the Republican National Committee, the Breitbart, to Fox News. And it'll be, you know, I'm just mindful that we need to make sure we're not part of the collateral damage that Trump continues to have. I don't think that he will be the next president, but But I do think he is tapping into a part of America that feels like they are marginalized, and that more hate and bigotry will actually be a positive thing for them, even if it's a negative thing for so many other people.
Right. We have, I agree with you. I think that Trump is tapping into a sector of the population that's hurting. 93% of the counties in the United States are still below where they were in 2007, 2008, because of the financial meltdown on Wall Street. People are hurting for jobs or stable employment. They're less secure. But it is, in a way, the open sort of coming out of the closet of white supremacy. Like, that's something new. Like, in the past, candidates who talk like Donald Trump talked would have just been driven out, but now he's ahead. I mean, that's something new in American politics. Maybe not new in the sense that we've never seen it before, but new in the last 30 or 40 years. I mean, do you sense a danger of a rising sort of white supremacist movement in the United States, perhaps as a backlash?
Yeah, and I would say I would agree with you in the sense that it is not new, right? And that we have, the KKK is not too far gone, that lynchings are relatively recent occurrences, that they are not 100 years ago, that they're still happened so recently. But Trump has been validated by mainstream media in a way that is new. New for my generation to experience up close and personal. And I think that they now realize that they were part of the making the monster, that they bear some culpability for that. I think that so many people were slow to realize the danger of Trump's candidacy and what he means in terms of being a coalescing force for people who believe in bigotry and racism. Trump is he is gifted at playing to the camera. In his reality TV background, I think helps exploit that more and more.
I mean, he's made the case all lives matter, obviously as a polemic against Black Lives Matter as a slogan. He says, we love the police. Black Lives Matter protesters have been violently attacked at his rallies. He invites that, in fact. And I was thinking about back to Ferguson, because you had that divide in Ferguson and throughout the country. When Wilson, Darrell Wilson, shot down Michael Ferguson and his body was left there for 4 hours, it led to outrage and rebellion and protest in the Black community and among white supporters and Latinos and other people. But there were big sectors of the white suburban St. Louis population that were rallying behind and providing money for the cop who killed Michael Brown just because he was the one who killed Michael Brown. I mean, you could sense in the last few years a growing sort of racial divide, the organization of white supremacy, and of course the role of the media. I'm just wondering if you consider that all part of the same pattern around Trump. Of course, Trump is focusing mainly on immigrants and Muslims for the hate, but what do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, I think that his candidacy is one that I hope is a flash in the pan and not indicative of candidates to come. Like I already said, I think that the media helped construct a candidate and helped give him airtime and legitimacy. And the reality is that the entire Republican bench is rather weak, that everybody thought Jeb was going to resonate differently. People thought that Rand Paul was going to resonate differently. But there is such a wave of anti-establishment politics happening, and Trump just fit into the right moment. You are right that in St. Louis, that there were many people who were supporting, financially at least, Darren Wilson and otherwise. And I think that, you know, there have always been people who have benefited from the status quo. And there are people who have fought against equity and justice at every turn. And that is no different in 2015 or 2014 or 2016. And that just makes our resolve even stronger to stay in the work because we know change can come, but that change requires real work.
So back to your mayoral campaign, we just have a few minutes left. When you go out, and when you leave here today, when you leave Washington, D.C., when you go to Baltimore, who's the main audience that you're targeting? Is it the young voter? Because, of course, we know that the big problem in elections, or one of the big problems, is that there's a very, very low turnout from poor people and from young people. Is it possible that a campaign like yours, like Sanders' campaign, even though he's a 73-year-old, that's generated the beginning of a youthful participation, youthful enthusiasm, and people actually joining in? Your campaign needs youth.
Yeah, so my core constituency is anybody who is interested in change in Baltimore City. I'm the only candidate not beholden to establishment politics. I'm the only candidate who is not taking money from big developers. the only one who has a robust platform that was robust from the moment that I entered the race, that's my constituency. And that means that it is a lot of young people, it's a lot of middle-aged people, it's older people, that the constituency is broad, and it is centered on people who believe that there is that change is possible, that we can build a coalition to do it, and that we have to make a different choice with regard to who our leadership is.
Right now, if you were not just the mayor of Baltimore, but say the president of the United States, what would be the top three things that you think would be the most important thing for the government to do to signal the population in terms of real, meaningful reform? What's the main things that need to happen right away?
Well, remember, at the federal level, so much of it is about money. It's about where money goes. So I think that holding local governments, police departments, you know, accountable with regard to how agencies spend money is really important. I think that at the federal level, there are important things that can happen with regard to housing. We know that houses are often the single largest asset that people own. And so many people in marginalized communities just don't have assets. And that means that we have to account for the history of redlining in the country. That means that we have to make loans more accessible for people. And then the third is about education, that not only K-12, but also adult education has to be a focus. So there's some community colleges doing incredible work. There's some community colleges that are really struggling and have abysmally low graduation rates. And that we have allowed the problem of adult education to compound so dramatically that we need to have an aggressive solution to it. And the fourth thing I'll say is about infrastructure. The infrastructure in our cities is old. It is crumbling. And that at some point, the cost is going to catch up to us. So if cities don't replace their water pipes and do major renovation to just the infrastructure, especially on the East Coast, at some point, the cost will be unmanageable. And the federal government has to come in and be a leader in the infrastructure work.
The infrastructure of the cities or the bridges or of the highways, that's crumbling. Certainly rail and mass public transportation. What's not crumbling from the point of view of federal budgeting, especially, is the military and the military-industrial complex. The United States spends, when you look at all of the different pieces of the military budget, not just the Defense Department, it's almost $1 trillion a year. That's more than the next 20 countries combined. The United States has 1,000 military installations in 130 countries all over the world, even though the last time the United States was invaded was the War of 1812, more than 200 years ago. From the point of view of politics, and now that you've entered the political race, what do you say, because obviously it has an impact when the United States government spends all of this money on weapons and on war or paying for past wars? What's the solution?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing at the local level. Most local governments spend a disproportionate amount of its money on police departments. That we have to focus, we have to make those investments and other investments, and we have to balance them out. At the city level, it's about making sure that we understand that crime prevention is not work of police, but that's the work of strong schools, jobs, and families. At the federal level, it's about making sure that we don't overinvest in the military and underinvest in domestic programs, and making domestic programs a real priority. That some of what makes us a safe country is that we have people with incredible talent, of the resources to live full lives and to contribute to society in meaningful ways. And that has to be part of how we think about safety.
So what would you do with the military budget?
Yep. So I'm not running for president. But like I've already said, I would continue to urge President Obama and Congress to make clear commitments to domestic programs, especially infrastructure, which is the less sexy but really important work. And to make sure that federal monies are used in ways that keep us safe at the international level, but also make deep commitments to domestic policy.
Yeah, the reason I'm asking is that as Bernie Sanders, who has an aggressive social domestic program for social change, free education, free medical care, he's always asked, well, how are you going to pay for it? And he says, well, we need a political revolution, which is, you know, sounds good, but it's also a bit vague. He doesn't talk about the military budget or he doesn't talk about it much. And I'm just wondering, even though I know you're running for mayor and not for the president of the United States, how important is the question of militarism and the United States? What I would see is the addiction to the military industrial complex, which has been true for almost a half a century. How important is that to actually fund a real reform program in terms of domestic programs. Martin Luther King said you can't drop bombs in Southeast Asia and Vietnam and not have them really explode in the inner cities of the United States, meaning you couldn't have a war on poverty and an imperialist war in Southeast Asia. Do you see it the same way?
You know, I'm running to be the next mayor of Baltimore. And when I think about the military-industrial complex, I think the way that that manifests at the city level is around the police-industrial complex. And I know that we can make different investments with our city dollars, that we can divert money from the police department budget and put that in real prevention work, that we can make sure that we have a more comprehensive understanding of safety that is not just centered on policing, that we can do those things. And I think that the city level is where most of that actually impacts people's lives day to day. That does not mean that the government has to fork over all the money, that they're private investors, that they're philanthropic partners who want to be a part of the solution. But we need to have a plan at the city level so that we can make sure that we are maximizing impact and actually addressing issues at scale.
In the last few years, and we have about 4 minutes left, in the last few years, we had the Occupy movement in 2011. That was a spontaneous movement. Then the movement for Black Lives, which came starting after the killing of Michael Brown. You see these kind of grassroots movements that have really become front and center. In 2011, in fact, Time magazine said the protester was the person of the year because there were protests all over the United States and, in fact, all over the world. You're running for political office. When you look at the two sort of elements of for change within the political system and through the political system and from the grassroots, how do you strike the balance? Do you see one as being more important, more decisive? How do you view it? I mean, that's a classic issue for all grassroots organizers.
Yeah, no, people will have to push from the outside. That has to be part of the work that's fundamental to the conception of democracy that we live in. People also need to do the work on the inside. I think a question for the movement is, can we be as organized on the inside as we've been on the outside? People have to be on the inside doing the work. That has to be a part of how we think about change. People also need to be on the outside pushing to make sure that there are conversations happening in public that will otherwise not happen and that issues are being brought to the forefront in important ways.
DeRay McKesson, you are running for mayor. You are running on a progressive campaign for significant reforms in the city of Baltimore. One of the big issues, of course, to overcome poverty is higher wages. You have the labor movement, which has been working with community groups and youth groups to demand a higher minimum wage, a $15 an hour minimum wage. Is your campaign able to attract support from the labor movement, either at the grassroots level or higher up? Is that one of your goals or one of your priorities to reach to the labor movement and to that movement for an improvement in low wages?
Yep. So I was the first candidate to come out and support a $15 minimum wage. And again, like I said, my campaign is focused on anybody in the city who wants change and transformational leadership. So it includes people who are formerly a part of the labor movement. It includes people who are in unions. It includes people who are not, but know that this is the right policy to move forward because it'll make the state, the region, and the city stronger. And I'm focused on that the economic platform that I put forth, it is about economic justice. It is about closing the racial wealth gap. And it is about saying that we can actually do these things, that these are real concrete things that we can do to make people's lives better today and tomorrow.
Obviously, your campaign has also drawn national attention to Baltimore because you are a national figure in the Black Lives Matter movement. In our last 90 seconds, you're getting considerable support, in spite of whatever the New York Times says, from within Baltimore. But talk about the support and the enthusiasm your campaign has generated on the national level. Who's supporting you?
Yep. So like I said, we have about 5,100 donations from all 50 states. More individual donors than all of the people I'm running against combined in the last filing deadline. And importantly, the third highest number of donors from Baltimore City. We run a national phone bank. We have people knocking doors from all across the city and the state. So there's a broad base of support, and I'm really proud of that. And I've talked to so many voters across the city who are also proud that I'm able to bring national attention to these issues and that my platform is informed from an understanding of what has worked and what has not worked in cities across the country, but that is deeply rooted in the city of Baltimore.
Well, that's all the time we have. We'll be back tomorrow. We want to thank DeRay McKesson for joining us for this full hour special episode of Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, It has to be loud and clear. We're out of here.
Loud and clear.